A 12-year-old boy spent as many as 21 hours a day locked in seclusion at an Iowa juvenile home. This hour, we hear his story. It's a NewsBuzz edition of River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. I'll talk with investigative reporter Jason Clayworth about that case and the settlement. Then, how a civil rights organization and a student are suing Iowa's Secretary of State over the state's new voter ID law. A wind energy milestone on the horizon, an update on chronic wasting disease among Iowa deer, and we start a new Friday series on the hazards of summer. Today, the dangers of heat. Buckle up for your NewsBuzz. First, this news from NPR.
Support for IPR and this podcast comes from Dr. Suzanne Stock, board-certified specialist in orthodontics. Dr. Stock is pleased to provide braces and Invisalign for children, teens, and adults in Iowa City and across Southeast Iowa. More online at drssortho.com.
It's a NewsBuzz edition of River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Well, for nearly 2.5 years, Jaquan Bradford, a boy with some emotional and mental disabilities, was held in isolation by the Iowa Department of Human Services for most of each day. That went on for 2.5 years, nearly. Last month, a state official acknowledged for the first time that what Iowa did to this young man, this boy, was wrong. And the Iowa Appeal Board has approved a $175,000 payment to settle a federal lawsuit in the matter. Joining us, Jason Clayworth, investigative reporter at the Des Moines Register, who's been digging into this story, has an extensive article on it. Jason, thank you for joining us.
Good afternoon, Ben. Thank you.
I want to warn our listeners, some may find parts of the next few minutes of conversation disturbing, what happened to Jaquan. First of all, Jason, how did Jaquan end up at the Iowa Juvenile Home in Toledo?
Jaquan Bradford had an extensive background of emotional and mental disabilities, and that resulted in him having some legal troubles as a young child. He ended up at the home in Toledo by the age of 12, and by that point he had already had an arrest record, and he had been diagnosed with multiple disabilities, and that's why he ended up at the Iowa Juvenile Home.
Another facet there that you put in your article, he'd suffered some abuse from an early age as well.
That's correct, and they all contributed to, according to his lawsuit against the state, all of these factors contributed to how he ended up at the juvenile home in Toledo.
For nearly 2.5 years, you outline in the article, Jaquan was held in isolation up to 21 hours a day. You paint a very disturbing picture of life for Jaquan. You spoke with Jaquan for this, and as well as his mother, Larisha. Describe what Jaquan told you about his conditions and the depths of despair he reached.
Jaquan described a situation of years of having deep emotional and psychological problems that stemmed from this isolation. He described, and his lawsuit also described, him pulling out his hair. At one point, he believed that people were in his room, in his isolated cell, that weren't there. He was hallucinating. He, at one point, was defecating on himself. He contemplated suicide. At one point during his stay, he became frustrated when he was informed that he was going back into isolation, and he ran both of his arms through a glass door, severing tendons in both hands. To this day, he's unable to unclench one of his fists. So he has permanent physical damage, and certainly continues to have psychological damage. And as an adult, he continues to struggle with his emotions and his behavior. He's spent time in prison, so he's had a lot of difficulties, not only as a teenager, but now as a young adult.
Mm-hmm. And you spoke with Jaquan's mother, LaRisha, and she was trying during these years to change the situation, remove him from all that seclusion.
Yes, LaRisha Bradford, his mother, tried multiple times. She says dozens of times to help her son, to remove her son from isolation. She says that she talked with judges, and the records certainly do reflect some of that I have seen. She's talked with judges. She asked DHS. Ultimately, when this issue, the bigger issue of isolation, became a public matter, she hired an attorney. So she went through an extensive number of steps trying to remove her son from the situation, and it took years before that happened.
Mm-hmm. I want to play a little audio that you have in your posting of this article from Jaquan Bradford here, just describing his thoughts on the tremendous amount of seclusion that he experienced for 2.5 years at the juvenile home in Toledo.
I don't know, instead of just locking somebody up or something, they do at least like talk to them or give them tell them. They don't even talk to you or nothing. They just lock you straight up. At least they could have talked to me or told me this is wrong, you can't do this, but this stuff like that.
Jason, give us the side of the DHS. What do you get from them when you go for the rationale for using seclusion in cases where someone is violent and has these mental and emotional disabilities?
Well, Ben, DHS has not defended their actions publicly, at least not declined to comment for this story. They continue to be as part of a federal lawsuit against them for using seclusion, and they cite that for reason for not talking about this. What we do know, however, is that seclusion historically had been used. It was long believed that that was an adequate way to deal with children that have behavioral emotional disorders and were out of control. We know today from research, there are multiple groups that are citing research and now are against seclusion. They say that is an archaic form of discipline or dealing with children, and that it has deep psychological impacts, negative impacts on children. And there are multiple national and state groups that are lobbying states, including Iowa, to abandon those efforts. And it's important to note that these groups aren't generally, they're not saying completely end seclusion. They say that there is very limited scope of circumstances in which it might be appropriate to seclude children, but only primarily whenever they are a danger to themselves or others, and only in that brief window of time.
Talk a little bit about an interesting facet here, too, before we paint the people who worked in these facilities in a certain light. The seclusion factor, you point out, can be leading to more workers being injured who look after these individuals.
Yes, that's the concern from some social workers has historically been that seclusion is important to obviously segregate a patient from other patients and staff as a safety measure. There are states that have implemented strict guidelines and restrictions against seclusion, Colorado being one of them, that have found that instead of an increased risk to staff, they've had fewer staff injuries, and as a result, they have higher graduation rates for the youth that are in their juvenile facilities and far less incidents where they have severe behavioral issues.
Mm-hmm. Now, the Iowa Juvenile Home in Toledo was closed. Governor Branstad closed that in 2014 after the Des Moines Register. Your paper detailed some use of this long-term isolation and the failure to comply with federal special education laws. Is that the only place in Iowa where such procedures were used?
We don't fully know the extent to where seclusion is or has been used at this point. We know, however, through the federal lawsuit filed by Disability Rights Iowa, that seclusion has been and is currently being used at a facility in Eldora. Now, that federal lawsuit is not seeking money from the state. That group is simply asking the state to reform their policy so that they take action that's similar to what Colorado and other states have done and limit the use of seclusion in juvenile facilities. So far, that hasn't happened.
The Iowa Appeal Board approving a $175,000 payment from the state to settle this federal lawsuit in the matter. You asked the question, I guess, of his mother, Larisha. Was the settlement a way to make Bradford's hush up, right? What was the answer there?
Yes. Larisha Bradford believes that the money that she received in the settlement was a way for the state to dismiss the bigger issue. She's concerned. She is concerned that this issue will continue, and she believes it was the state's way to continue what it's doing, its operations, and dismiss the bigger issue.
Mm-hmm. Jason, before we go, what will you be following in this story in the future?
Well, certainly the federal lawsuit that Disability Rights Iowa has filed against the state is significant. Iowa is one of seven or fewer states we know that that has some pretty wide-ranging uses of seclusion in juvenile facilities, and so it's really an outlier. And so going forward, I will be watching the federal lawsuit and as well as the state's actions to see if those change, and we'll of course be reporting on those.
Okay, Jason Clayworth, we appreciate it. Investigative reporter at the Des Moines Register talking about a settlement in the case of a boy who was locked away for up to 21 hours a day in an Iowa juvenile home. Jason, thank you so much.
Thank you for having me, Ben.
It's River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer, a News Buzz edition. Quick conversations on this Friday. Well, a civil rights organization and an Iowa State University student are suing Iowa's Secretary of State, Paul Pate, over Iowa's new voter ID law. The organization filing the lawsuit, the League of United Latin American Citizens of Iowa, LULAC, the ISU student, Taylor Blair, filed at Polk County District Court. Joe Henry is with us of LULAC. Hello, Joe Henry.
Hello. Good to be on.
Now, you did, in fact, file this suit. It wasn't clear to the Secretary of State that you had yet, but have you filed this lawsuit?
It was filed as of 2 p.m. yesterday.
Okay. What is the ground for the lawsuit?
Well, the ground for the lawsuit is that it's unconstitutional according to the Iowa State Constitution, that it prevents the right to vote and fair and equal treatment. And, of course, the way we see this is it's restricting the amount of time to do absentee ballots. It's requiring a different type of identification to do the walk-in vote. And it's also requiring electronic signature verification starting next year. All of this is restricting the right to vote, and that's why we did the lawsuit.
I want to have you react to a statement that we got about the lawsuit from Secretary of State Paul Pate, provided yesterday, and thus I assume in the meantime they have official notification. Let me read it quickly and have you react. My office has not received an official notification of a lawsuit filed against us. However, based on materials provided to us by the media, I am disappointed at this effort to politicize Iowa's voting process, apparently timed to disrupt the June 5th primary elections. This is a baseless and politically motivated lawsuit paid for by the Democratic Party's top super PAC. One of the plaintiffs is suing even though he was able to cast a regular ballot after failing to bring identification to the polls. The other plaintiff has repeatedly been asked for its feedback and suggestions on our voter education initiatives and strategies. They have also been provided with numerous tools to help provide voting information to their members. And the last couple of sentences from the Secretary of State's office, throughout the legislative process, the laws and court decisions from other states were analyzed to ensure this law had adequate safeguards to protect voters' rights. I am confident the law protects those rights and the integrity of elections in Iowa. The Attorney General's office will be defending us in this case. Talk to the charge there that this is really about being a political disruptor for the June 5th primary.
Yeah, we would disagree with that. This is not a disruptor. The Secretary of State has provided information. They have welcomed us for comment, but our comments have always been that this is unfair legislation that restricts the right to vote. They have provided educational material, but the material basically states is this is the new way of voting. This is what you have to provide. And all that information is on the restrictions of the voting. Bottom line is this has reduced the amount of time for absentee balloting. As we all know, in 2016, about 50% of those people who voted in Iowa during that general election voted by absentee ballot. So reducing the amount of time from 140 days to 70 days to begin the absentee ballot process and then actually turning in the absentee ballots from 40 days to 29 days is clearly a restriction. And then reducing the amount of types of ID to provide during the day of voting is damaging, it's detrimental to the right to vote. So all of this is unfair. He has politicized this by the fact that in 2016, he stated in regards to Trump's comments, allegations that there was voter fraud, that in Iowa we did not have voter fraud in 2016. But yet in 2017, he went and promoted this hateful bill, which was passed by the Republican-controlled legislature, which restricted the right to vote. So we totally disagree with him, and we're fighting for our constitutional rights to fair elections. And we will meet him in the courtroom.
Okay, and quickly, before we go, what are you seeking exactly?
Well, we want to return to the way voting was done beforehand. We want the prior amount of time to do absentee balloting. We want to go back to the regular IDs at the time of voting. And we do not want electronic signature verification, which cannot be done by volunteered.
Okay, thank you very much. Joe Henry, Midwest Region Leader for the League of United Latin American Citizens, LULAC. Joe Henry, thank you.
Thank you very much.
It's a News Buzz edition of River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Quick conversations to end our work week. A milestone on the horizon for wind-generated power here in Iowa. This week, MidAmerican Energy said it plans to invest $922 million in added wind power capacity, and that would equal as much renewable energy as customers of MidAmerican Energy use. Dan Lutat is with us, Iowa Lakes Community College Director for Sustainable Energy. Welcome to the program, Dan.
Thanks for having me.
This investment by MidAmerican, I understand, is subject to approval by the Iowa Utilities Board. But how significant is this?
Well, I think it's very significant. It shows that, you know, with a little bit of common sense and the right folks behind it, we can develop a renewable resource that's really good for Iowans, that helps, maintain our electric power utility rates at a stable level while we're doing development at the same time. And, you know, it's a win-win for everybody, including the rural Iowa communities that are benefiting from the long-term impact of these projects.
Mm-hmm. Now, I understand MidAmerican is saying it will be the first investor-owned electric utility nationally to meet this goal. That's significant. Iowa, we know, is at the forefront of wind energy, right?
Exactly, and we produce much of the energy in the state. We're well over 36% now for energy in the state being drawn from wind energy alone. So, you know, when you think about it, we're as that renewable resource is being developed, it's actually being used. So every stick that goes in the ground, we're actually selling power to somebody that's actually utilizing that resource. So it's not only a future resource, but as soon as it gets plugged in, it's on demand right now. So readily available, very reliable over wide geographic areas. So the business case is just too good for it right now.
Right. Most of our energy or power is still generated by coal, but I'm looking at a statistic that's really quite inspiring. Iowa's reliance on coal for electricity dropping from 76% 10 years ago to 45% in 2017. That's pretty amazing.
Right, and that's really the value of renewables. You know, everybody knows we need to have a layered power system. So in the United States, we're kind of the envy of a lot of countries around the world because we have a very robust, very survivable layered power transmission system and generation system. So while we still need those hydrocarbons, being able to shut down plants or not build plants that are generating those obnoxious chemicals into the atmosphere, you know, that's a big deal. So we're contributing to the forestalling any kind of climate change, and at the same time, you know, we can reverse those effects over time by using those renewable resources. So, you know, the big thing is we keep that reliability in our power system, but we decrease the reliance on things that we know down the road we may need again. You know, that next best idea in energy is probably two centuries away. So,
what has this meant, or what will it mean in terms of job creation here in Iowa?
Well, you'll see several dozen permanent jobs in terms of the technicians that will be maintaining this new project site. So that'll be in addition to what's already out there. So the benefit there is, while those numbers don't necessarily sound like a lot, what you're really doing there is those are families right there. It's not just a technician. These are technicians that have a family income, a stable future where they want to be, and they're going to raise their families in our community. So not only do you have the benefit of the lease payments and the tax benefits coming back into those counties, you've got long-term, stable, technical jobs that are durable that are raising families in our area, and that's a major impact. And so even after construction, what people don't realize is that a lot of these turbines are still going to require routine specialty guys that come through and do everything from blade inspection and repair to crane crews that need to come in and assist these site technicians with up-tower repairs when they're necessary. So there's a steady stream that goes on during the life of the project that, while those may not be resident jobs, they still contribute to our economy. These are folks that are going to be eating in our restaurants, buying their fuel, staying in those hotels, and in some cases for long periods, depending on the job.
Dan, very quick, we have less than a minute. Say a word to the opposition to expanding wind power. Some rural Iowa residents are opposed to more wind farms. Some say construction damages farmland. The turbines disrupt rural living.
Well, I would say to them that, you know, so far I haven't seen one cogent argument from the anti-staff there. And so what it really boils down to is the common denominator there is folks that say that they're against that. Really, it boils down to the fact that, you know, they get annoyed about a lot of things. And so we have to look past that. And if you sit down with some of those folks and you have a casual conversation with them about it, you know, they tend to come around. So when the newness wears off, I think you'll see people that, you know, even if they're against it now or maybe don't understand it fully, as they get educated about the benefits of it and what's really going on with wind development, they'll come around. But again, you know, they have every right to their point of view, and all we can do is put the facts on the table and see where we can go with the participating landowners. So.
Okay. Thank you. Dan Lutat, Iowa Lakes Community College Director for Sustainable Energy. Thanks, Dan.
You bet. Thanks for having us.
Coming up after a short break, we'll talk about, we'll have an update on chronic wasting disease among Iowa deer. Also, we start a new Friday series on the hazards of summer. Today, the dangers of heat. Speaking of heat, we'll talk in a moment with an expert on volcanic plumbing. What's happening beneath Kilauea out in the Pacific? It's a NewsBuzz edition of River to River. I'm Ben Kiefer, back in just a moment.
Support for IPR and this podcast comes from Dr. Suzanne Stock, board-certified specialist in orthodontics. Dr. Stock is pleased to provide braces and Invisalign for children, teens, and adults in Iowa City and across Southeast Iowa. More online at drssortho.com.
It's Friday News Buzz edition of River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. If you want to tune in on Monday, we haven't had an update on cancer identification and treatment, but we will on Monday. One of my guests, Dr. George Wiener, he's the director of the Holden Comprehensive Cancer Center at the University of Iowa. He's going to tell us about a newly approved treatment that uses a patient's own white blood cells to detect and kill cancer cells. This particular type of immunotherapy is called CAR T-cell therapy, and the UI is among the first sites in the nation to use it on patients. So we'll talk about that. Also, we're going to welcome your questions about cancer and cancer treatment during the entire hour this coming Monday. Well, this is the time of year we start to see young deer, fawns, out and about in the wilderness, perhaps also in your backyard. Wildlife experts ask people who are tempted to not rescue solo fawns. This is because they're frequently on their own throughout the day, and it's natural. The mother's going to come back. Also because earlier this year, the Iowa DNR notified wildlife rehabilitators that the state will no longer give permits to groups that rehabilitate white-tailed deer. Most often, these are fawns. We'll get some background on this from Adam Janke, assistant professor and extension wildlife specialist at Iowa State University. Adam, welcome to the program.
Hi, thanks for having me.
Let's go through the problem of well-intentioned people wanting to rescue wildlife babies, not just deer, right?
That's right. Yeah, this is the time of the year that we run into that the most. And it is, of course, well-intentioned, as you said. But most of the time when we find wild babies on the ground or what seem to be alone, mom is often pretty close by watching, but just is kind of afraid to show herself. And it's always best, almost without exception, to walk away from wild babies and let mom come back and take care of them the way nature intends.
Mm-hmm. Are there any exceptions there? I mean, we can see a young animal look like it's in distress, right? We should never, ever do anything?
Well, there certainly are exceptions, and it's best to consult with a professional wildlife rehabilitator, wildlife conservation officer, wildlife biologist to kind of identify those. But things that are really obvious would be, for example, if the mother of a fawn gets hit on the road. Like, those are kind of the extreme examples where we know the mother isn't there and can't help. But other things, even things as simple as, you know, baby birds falling out of nests, people think that that may be the end of it. And that's really just not true. We see that wildlife are pretty resilient, of course, can deal with those adversities. And the best way for a baby animal to be raised is in the natural environment where the parents are.
Comment, Adam, on an update on chronic wasting disease among our deer and what's being done now.
Yeah, chronic wasting disease is one of the issues, of course, we're worried about with white-tailed deer. And it's a it's a pretty unique challenge, and it's a relatively new challenge in Iowa. It's a type of disease called a transmissible spongiform encephalopathy. Folks from the ag community will recognize that's the same thing as mad cow and scrapie that we see in sheep and goats. And this is a pretty unique type of disease, and different than viruses and bacteria and things that are a little more intuitive. And so the challenge that this disease presents is that it's 100% fatal when it's found in wild deer, in elk and other members of the deer family. And once it's in the environment, it's really hard to get rid of. And so right now in Iowa, chronic wasting disease is only in two known places in wild deer. That's northeastern Iowa and Allamakee and Clayton County. And then just this last fall, as part of routine monitoring, the Iowa DNR detected it in Wayne County. And so we're really worried about monitoring the disease and minimizing potential impacts of the disease in those areas. And then we want everybody across the state to be aware of the disease and how it is that we are going to address this challenge moving forward here in Iowa.
What will a deer look like if it's got this white, this chronic wasting disease?
That's a great question. And what it'll look like is a normal deer for the most part. And that's another challenge that chronic wasting disease presents, is that the disease has a long incubation period before the animals become symptomatic. So it can actually be up to 18 months, as many as 3 years even, but the typical exposure or incubation period is 18 months. And many times the symptoms start to become more severe as the animal has had the disease longer. And oftentimes we see CWD-infected deer actually die of things that are maybe a secondary result of the infection, rather than wasting away, as the name may imply. ultimately, at the very end of the disease, I said it's 100% fatal. The animal would show symptoms of being really sick, but it would be like excess salivation, poor balance, and starvation, you know, exposed rib cages. But that's consistent with a lot of symptoms of a sick deer. So what we say with CWD is we often don't have a body count. We don't see a lot of deer dying of wasting away, but the disease is definitely affecting their neurological function, and it's affecting the populations in potentially really meaningful ways as it becomes more prevalent.
Mm-hmm. What's behind this move by the Iowa Department of Natural Resources telling groups of volunteers they'll no longer give permits to groups that rehabilitate whitetail deer?
Yeah, I think what the DNR is doing, basically the only tools we have to fight this disease is to minimize the spread. Because like I said, once it's in the wild, it's not going anywhere. The prions that cause this disease persist in the wild for up to 10 years. Animals can pick it up from the environment without ever interacting with an infected individual. And so what the only chance we have essentially for minimizing the impacts of this disease in Iowa is to minimize the spread. And the ways we can do that is basically not moving deer and then also not allowing deer to come into artificially high concentrations with other deer. And the concern with this, I think, with the rehabilitators is that both of those things would be playing out. We'd be bringing deer in from the wild that could potentially have the disease, but of course be asymptomatic as a young deer. They could have the disease. That could transmit it to other deer that are held at the facility or contaminate the facility itself through environmental contamination. And then once those animals are released back into the wild, that could perhaps be a long distance away from the animal where the animal was originally picked up. And you could imagine a scenario. I mean, the probabilities are low, but there's a possible scenario where you could be moving that disease and introducing it into a new area where it wouldn't have been otherwise. So,
we have about 30 seconds left. Adam, a quick word to the future here. Will this CWD, chronic wasting disease, continue to spread? Do we know?
Yeah, we know from the experience of other Midwestern states that CWD is here to stay, and yes, CWD is going to spread. What we're working on is trying to find ways to minimize the rate of that spread, and that means we need to move deer as little as we can, find ways to reduce densities of deer, and definitely discourage people from congregating deer around artificial feed or mineral supplementation sites, and just basically become aware of the disease and know what you can do to help, and all hands on deck kind of a approach to this challenge that will be with us for a while.
Adam Janekeep, Assistant Professor and Extension Wildlife Specialist at Iowa State University. Thanks so much for the tips, Adam.
Yes, thank you. Have a good day.
You too. It's a News Buzz edition of River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Well, it's been 4 weeks since the first eruptions from that volcano on the Big Island, Hawaii, Kilauea. Last week, if you tuned into our program, I spoke with a former Iowa resident, John Little. He now lives on the island of Hawaii with his wife, Sue. Well, this week, let's check in with an expert on active tectonics, including earthquakes, tsunamis, landslides, and also, of course, volcanic eruptions. Bill Barnhart is in our Iowa City studio, Assistant Professor of Earth and Environmental Science at the University of Iowa. Thanks for stopping by, Bill.
Good afternoon. Thanks for having me.
So what's the latest you're following on Kilauea?
Well, it's still continuing. It's been going since May 3rd. There hasn't been big changes in what's going on at the eruptions, but they're very dramatic right now. There's a 250-foot tall lava fountain that's erupting fairly continuously. There's continued ash explosions from the summit of Kilauea, and it doesn't seem like there's an end in sight anytime soon.
Right. And this volcano has many vents. I guess that you must be talking about a central vent, but what did I read? Like 20 different vents coming out of this volcano.
Right now, there's a line of fissures. It's called the Eastern Rift Zone of Kilauea, which is a long line of fractures that extend out to the east end of the island there, of which there's 20 or so active fissures at this time that lava is erupting from. Now, these are different from the summit of Kilauea, which is where the ash eruptions occur. So there's sort of two different locations right now of activity. There's the lava eruptions out on the East Rift Zone, close to these the Leilani Estates, these neighborhoods, and then within the national park itself at the summit where you have these large ash eruptions.
Mm-hmm. We have a lot of media exposure for this. It is indeed a tremendously fascinating
thing that that is happening in Hawaii on the Big Island. But we have sort of a larger than life view of what it's how much of the island this is happening to. It's actually a small fraction of the island.
It's a very small area. It's only on the edge of the island there. And some of the hazards, of course, that arise from this are the lava flows. And those are going into neighborhoods, and those affect infrastructure.
Sure.
There's, of course, the atmospheric hazards, the ash itself, and this thing called VOG, which is sulfur dioxide that gets released from the volcano and gets into the atmosphere, as well as glass. So something called Pele's hair and Pele's tears that forms when these lavas quench instantaneously. And those can become airborne, almost like asbestos, and can be a hazard. But luckily in this part of the island, most of that's drifting offshore. So it's a fairly small area that's affected by these different hazards.
Mm-hmm. So let's talk a little bit about your role here. You're an assistant professor of earth and environmental sciences here at the University of Iowa, many thousands of miles away from Kilauea here. So are you studying actually what's happening there?
We're looking at one aspect of it, which is the earthquakes. These are extraordinarily dynamic systems, these magmatic systems. So when you start to have these eruptions, you have lava flows, you have ash, but you also have earthquakes, you have fluid flow, all kinds of different things going on. Kilauea is one of the best instrumented volcanoes in the world. It goes everywhere from on-site eye looking at the ground with cameras. There's seismometers all over the island, tilt meters and GPS that measure how the ground deforms, moves up and down.
Mm-hmm.
And then we can also do that from outer space with satellites. So what my research group does is we study it from the satellite perspective using images acquired from different types of platforms to measure how the ground deforms. And when you have a large earthquake or a groundswell or deflation from the volcano, we can measure that. And this all starts to be put together to try and get sort of a full three-dimensional view of what the volcanic plumbing system looks like.
Mm, okay. So are there a lot of mysteries surrounding volcanoes still yet to be researched and answered?
There are many. So from a scientific perspective, this is a very it's almost a generational event. There's going to be students who work on this volcanic eruption for their entire careers coming forward, because there's questions like, when do volcanoes erupt? What causes them to erupt? Are there warning signals? One of the big unknowns about this eruption is, when is it going to stop? It could stop today. It could be years before it stops. So information that's garnered from this event, all this scientific information and data that's being collected, is going to be used to try and provide better knowledge about that in the future, both for Hawaii and for other volcanoes around the world. How do you predict when an eruption is going to happen, when it's going to cease, how big is it going to be?
Mm-hmm. Have you been out to see Kilauea in the last few weeks?
Not in the last few weeks. I've been out there before, but not in the last few weeks. We had a field trip from our department go a couple months ago, just before the eruption started, though.
Mm-hmm. What is the most fascinating part of this for you with your expertise?
Mine is how the volcano breathes. You can see from satellites how portions of the island will expand while others will deflate, and then it switches back and forth. So what you're seeing is magma that's building up in one location suddenly being released to a different location. So the ground drops back down, another area swells up, you have an eruption, sometimes there's earthquakes. So it's this really time and space dynamic behavior of the volcano itself.
Fascinating. We'll have to invite you back again. There's a lot of untapped knowledge there that I'd like to discover with you, Bill Barnhart, Assistant Professor of Earth and Environmental Science at the University of Iowa. Thanks for coming in, Bill.
Thank you for having me.
Well, from heat in a volcano and lava, we go to heat in Iowa. This week, we're starting a new News Buzz series during the warmer months to focus on summer hazards of all sorts. The next weeks, we want to talk about water recreation, farming and gardening hazards, biking, cycling, fireworks at the start of July, maybe a little before that. But let's start off with a hazard that has presented itself unusually early this year: heat, our weather. And joining us is Fiona Johnson, director of the Johnson County Ambulance Services. Fiona, welcome to the program.
Thank you for having me.
Now, we haven't had just out of a very warm May, record-setting May in many days. Have you and your EMTs been dealing with a lot of heat-related issues?
We certainly have. It's not only important for us to recognize the heat emergencies among ourselves with our working in the environment at regular times, but also to see that in our patients. And so happy to be here today just so we can kind of share the warning signs with people so they can be prepared.
Okay. Tell me, what do you when you're sent out and it's a heat-related issue, what are you commonly addressing?
Well, a lot of times as you're arriving on scene, you're kind of putting the pieces of the puzzle together as you're approaching. And so you're trying to determine what is the ambient temperature? What am I seeing? What position is the patient presenting in? Have they been outside working in the garden or in a factory that has poor circulation? Or are they out at the state fair or the county fair or been cycling? So what is it that has led up to the current situation? And then we're assessing their mental status. So if somebody is talking coherently and able to answer all our questions appropriately, they might have the early stages of heat illness, which would be like heat cramps or heat exhaustion. But as it progresses and they get more confused or could lose consciousness, potentially have seizures, that's moving into heat stroke, which was definitely more of a medical emergency.
Mm. And in cases of heat stroke, do you lose consciousness?
You certainly can. Mm-hmm. Certainly can.
So the first symptoms, when someone's out working in the yard, what are the first symptoms you should be? Of course, you want to drink water. You want to take breaks. You want to get into air conditioning.
Sure.
Give your body a break, right? But if you're out, maybe you're employed somewhere and you can't take a break. So what should you be aware of as far as symptoms in you or a colleague maybe?
Sure, definitely. There's a nice new mnemonic called HEAT. And so you are wanting to hydrate yourself. And so if you're, let's say, know that you haven't been hydrating prior to your exposure to the elements, that is, you know, something that you need to take into consideration. So if you start feeling thirsty, if you have excessive sweating, feeling very hot and flushed, if it progresses into excessive fatigue or dizziness, these are kind of the early warning signs. But if it gets further and you're now feeling more dizzy, you're confused, these are progressing more rapidly to your heat exhaustion. Excuse me. And so it's at these moments that you have to recognize, okay, there's a problem and you need to move to the shade. You need to rest and then hydrate. And when I say hydrate, I don't mean coffee or iced coffee or anything like that. Nothing with caffeine. You want water or something with electrolytes, something that will actually start rehydrating you. So those are the important first three steps to – so shade, rest, hydrate.
Mm-hmm. And if you should be in an area where perhaps an EMT isn't immediately available, what can you do for – a friend or a colleague who's experienced some of these symptoms?
Well,
some of those things.
Definitely. So to remember to educate yourself, whether that's, you know, with the signs and symptoms that we've talked about, or also just kind of mentally preparing yourself for the fact that you might need to be the person rendering first aid to somebody having a heat-related emergency. So that is kind of, what are you going to do? That would be help move somebody into the shade, help get them hydrated. You can put cool compresses on their neck, in their armpits. If you have water accessible, you'll kind of wet their face, fan their face, kind of get air movement. If they have restrictive clothing, you're going to want to loosen the clothing and then call for assistance. 911, we're here for you as a resource. If you call us, that does not mean that the person has to go with us in the ambulance. Yeah. Use us as a resource. We can come and check a temperature and help rehydrate. So,
Fiona, before we say goodbye, of course, overheated vehicles, a big problem. They can heat up very quickly at this time of year.
Yes, very dangerous. Don't leave any children, pets, or elderly alone in the car without the air conditioning running. Just leaving your window cracked is not sufficient. Within 10 minutes of leaving the vehicle turned off, the temperature in the vehicle can raise by 20 degrees, and within half an hour, it could be up to about 35 to 40 degrees warmer than the outside temperature. So just stay away from that.
Okay. Fiona Johnson, thank you very much. Kicking off our summer hazards series on our Friday News Buzz.
Thank you.
Fiona is director of the Johnson County Ambulance Services. We appreciate it, Fiona.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
So we're end of the hour of our News Buzz, and only left to do is to groove on into the weekend with Tony Daner, Iowa Public Radio host for Studio One Tracks. Tony?
Hey, Ben. How you doing?
I'm doing good. What do you got for us
this
weekend? Because I know there's plenty of great programming coming up on Studio One.
There sure is. And here's a song that we're actually going to hear over the weekend on Studio One Tracks. This is a great band from Philadelphia. I've just gotten into Low Cut Connie, a real kind of kind of bar rock and roll band. Try to imagine if Jerry Lee Lewis was the lead singer of The Replacements, and you're kind of halfway there with Low Cut Connie. And this song we're going to hear is called Beverly.
Okay, Low Cut Connie, take it away.
Down on my knees, you read a paper and watch TV. Don't even say a single word to me. Talk to me, you're slipping away. Sit around a trailer and sleep all day. Something funny and you just won't say it's not okay.
A little bit of Low Cut Connie, courtesy of Tony Daner, one of our hosts on Iowa Public Radio Studio One. Plenty more tracks for you to hear on Studio One this weekend. River to River is produced by Emily Woodbury, Ben Stanton, and Lindsay Moon. Help from Natalia Reyes as well. Let's kick into a little more music. Tony, I don't know if you're still there.
Sure am.
What do you got for us now?
This is Star Child and the New Romantic, and this song is called Language, the title track from the new album.
Okay, Tony, thanks.
Thank you.
River to River is a production of Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Thanks for joining us.